Hello, and welcome to Pardes from Jerusalem, the podcast series from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies in Jerusalem. I'm Larry Kluger, a Pardes alum. This week, I'm delighted to welcome back Rabbi Meir Schweiger, who will be discussing this week's Parsha, Vayitzé. Rabbi Meir Schweiger is our senior faculty member at Pardes and serves as a Pardes Mashkiach Ruchani, the spiritual guide for Pardes. And now, Rabbi Meir Schweiger.
Thank you, Larry, for the introduction. To all of our podcast listeners, I would like to tell you how wonderful it is to be back recording after so many months of inactivity. As many of you know, the last few months I've spent involved in renovations and moving, with many stressful moments. But at this point, that is a thing of the past, and I'm raring to go to resume recording to bring you what I hope will be first-rate quality recordings. In previous podcasts, I examined the personality of Yaakov, his trials and tribulations, his struggles and challenges, everything that he needed to go through to forge his personality and ultimately to make him the founder of the Jewish people who are referred to by his name. In today's podcast, Parshat Vayetze, I would like to examine the personality of his father-in-law, Lavan. In order to do so, let us go back to Parshat Chayei Sarah, where Lavan first appears. When Avraham's servant, Eliezer, comes to Haran, seeking a wife for Yitzchak, sets up a test, and subsequently encounters Rivka, who passes his test with flying colors. Eliezer gives Rivka presents, asks her whom she is, bows down, and thanks God for having brought him to the house of his master's brother. And we're told that Rivka tells her mother's house, everything that happened. But in chapter 24, verse 29, all of a sudden we shift. And we're told that Rivka had a brother whose name is Lavan. And Lavan runs to the man outside by the spring. At first glance, Lavan seems to be like his sister, someone who is running, someone who is hospitable, someone who is very much in the image of Avraham. But then in verse 30, we're told, when he sees the nose ring and the bracelets on his sister's hands, and when he hears the words of his sister saying, "Thus did the man speak to me," he comes to the man, and behold, he is standing by his camels by the spring. All of a sudden, there's a shift. Lavan is no longer running. What generates the change? He sees the bracelet. He hears the story. It's very striking. I would have expected that after hearing the story, hearing the words, that he would have run even quicker, but he doesn't. Is it because he does not want to seem to be an opportunist? Is it because he's playing cool and, in fact, is the master opportunist? This is one of the dilemmas that we have regarding Lavan. Who is he really? Is he, as his name seems to say, Lavan? White, pure of character. Or if I take the letters of his name and reverse it, it spells Naval, a scoundrel. Is he somebody who genuinely is hospitable, welcoming, caring? Or is it all a facade with ulterior motives, a facade that enables him to be very manipulative? Let us continue reading. In chapter 24, verse 31, he says to the servant, "Come, you who are blessed of God, why should you stand outside? I have cleared out the house, and there is room for the camels." Once again, at face value, it sounds very positive. He calls him the blessed of God, acknowledging both God and this individual's relationship with God. He offers them hospitality, not only for him, but also for his camels. He highlights it by saying he's cleared out the house. There's plenty of room. But then when we get to verse 32, verse 33, it is very interesting. The man comes to the house. He opens up, unloosens his camels. He places straw, fodder, before the camels. Water to bathe his feet and the feet of the men that are with him. Who is doing all of the acting here? The simplest way of reading the text is Eliezer, the servant of Avram. He is the one who is unloading his camels, who's bringing the straw, bringing the water. In verse 33, and food is brought before them to eat. Note the fact, Lavan is not mentioned in verse 32. He is not mentioned as the one who brings the food, although he could have been the one who brought it. But it's mentioned in the passive form. There's a very striking contrast between the person who initially runs out to the man and who all of a sudden is no longer running. Maybe let me also interject. It is very striking that Rivka's father, Bituel, does not appear here. And then we're told how the servant retells his story. And if we do a little bit of a fast forward, in chapter 24, verse 50, and Lavan and Bituel respond and say, the matter has gone out from God. We cannot say anything to you, whether bad or good. Once again, saying that the matter has gone out from God, is a very positive statement. It's affirming what Eliezer so passionately believes, that there has been divine providence in bringing him to this place, in finding Rivka, so that they too are expressed, Lavan too is expressing his belief in divine providence. Is that really so? Or is Lavan just paying lip service to Eliezer, speaking his language, knowing how to pull the right strings? I realize that some people would say, why are you looking to find something negative about Lavan? Why does it always have to be that the Jews, quote unquote, are the good guys, and somehow the non-Jews that they encounter are the bad guys? Why paint things black and white? Why look for a problem when it's not really there? And my response is that sometimes things, rather than being black and white, really are complex. And sometimes maybe we can things as they appear on the surface, but have to also see the body language, see the nuances, read between the lines, be able to take one statement, but put it into a context. In verse 50, one of the things that stands out is that Lavan responds before his father. At the very least, that would seem to indicate that Lavan is a dominant personality, his father a very passive one, which does not have to be negative. In fact, it might even be that because his father is so passive, that he needs to be the one who plays the lead role. On the other hand, there is also the issue which is raised by it of honoring one's parents. And especially in the ancient world, it would have been appropriate to go to the father to ask for his daughter's hand in marriage, and that the father should be the one who consents, perhaps in consultation with the brothers, but ultimately the father is the head of the household. And yet, as I said, Lavan seems to be the one who dominates. And this is certainly clear when we read subsequently that after this verse, Bituel does not appear. It is only Lavan and Rivka's mother. But now let me look a little bit further. After they say that the matter has gone out before God, in verse 51, Lavan says, behold, here is Rivka before you. Take her and go, and let her be a wife to your master's son, as God has said. Taking this verse at face value, Lavan has agreed to give Rivka in marriage. But even more than that, he said, take her, go, which would seem to say, don't waste your time. Get a move on. I've given my consent. Let it be. If I fast forward to verse 54, it says, they eat, they drink, he and the men that were with him, they lodge, they get up in the morning, and then Eliezer says, send me to my master. And we would see this as perhaps part of etiquette, that you ask permission, ask leave of the people that you're by. And then all of a sudden, in verse 55, and her brother and mother said, let the girl stay with us. Yamim, which Rashi says means a year, o asor, or 10 months. Achar telech, and then afterwards she will go. I don't understand. Initially, Laban said, take her and go. What happened in the interim that all of a sudden they start saying, wait, hold on. She needs to stay a year, 10 months perhaps. By the way, the word yamim could be understood as days. The only problem, as Rashi notes, is it would not make sense to say, let her stay a few days, oh, maybe 10. Normally, when you ask for something and then backtrack, you backtrack, default to something which is less rather than more, which prompts Rashi to say yamim means a year. What's the logic? The logic is she needs to get together her dowry. She needs to prepare herself. The problem is, but why all of a sudden are you saying it? Why didn't you say it initially? Now again, to try to defend Lavan, one could say that initially he gets very caught up with the moment, doesn't think it through, says, go, take her. But then all of a sudden realizes, but wait a second, maybe she needs to prepare herself before she goes. But one could also say, as appears to be in the Midrash, that in verse 53, when the servant gives them silver and gold utensils and clothing, when he gives Rivka, all of these presents, and gives her brother and mother migdanot, sweet things, the idea that here is an opportunity to cash in may be a very real consideration in delaying the marriage. Ambiguous, unclear. And the servant then says, but do not delay me. God has helped me succeed in my mission. And they say, let us call the girl and ask her. Certainly, through modern lenses, this is what you'd expect. She's a person. She has a mind of her own. She should be the one who's expressing her will. The only question is, to what degree is Lavan ahead of his time? How modern is he? Or is this just a ploy, a delaying tactic, knowing, or at least thinking he knows, that Rivka will refuse to go immediately, and it backfires? When in verse 55, they call her and Rivka says, yes, she will go. To summarize what we find in Parshat Chayei Sarah, Lavan displays various features that would seem to be positive. Acknowledgement of God, acknowledgement of divine providence, blessing the servant of Abraham as the one who is blessed by God, exercising hospitality, inviting the person into his home, feeding him, agreeing immediately to the marriage. And yet with all of these expressions, which are very positive, there seems to be a counterbalance. There seems to be a certain withdrawal. Initially, Lavan runs, then he's no longer running. He offers a lot, but when they come to his house, he doesn't seem to be involved in actually serving them. Initially, he agrees, let her go, take her. And then all of a sudden backtracks and says, but maybe she should wait a little bit. So there seems to be this pattern of doing something which is very, very positive, and then all of a sudden withdrawing, holding back. Which then raises the question, So who is Lavan? Is the real Lavan a person with values, a person who believes in God, who perhaps sometimes gets a little bit carried away and then has to tone it down a little bit, put it in perspective? Or is it that all of these demonstrations of religiosity, morality, are all of them a facade? A facade for an agenda, which is to further his well-being, to exploit a situation. Let us come to our parsha. When Yaakov first comes to Lavan, we're told the following. Maybe we'll begin with chapter 29, verse 12. And Yaakov told Rachel that he is her father's brother. He's the son of Rivka. And she runs and she tells her father. And note, verse 13. And when Lavan heard the story of Yaakov, his nephew, he runs to greet him. He hugs him. He kisses him. He brings him into the house. And he tells Lavan all of these words. In a similar pattern to what happened in Parshat Chaye Sarah, Lavan runs, except that here it's even more dramatic. He hugs him, he kisses him, and we could easily understand that the reason that he's doing this, he's family. It would be inappropriate in Parshat Chaye Sarah for him to go and kiss and hug Eliezer, who's a stranger. Note the fact that here he runs after he hears the story. Very, very positive. He brings him into the house. Once again, the hospitality. Note the difference with the story of Eliezer, that he doesn't just invite him. Here he actually brings him in. Note also the difference. We're not told that he prepares him a meal. We're told he brings him into the house, and then Yaakov tells Lavan all these words. It is unclear what is he telling him. The easiest thing would be to say that he's telling him that he's looking for a wife, and that specifically he was sent to go to Lavan to find a wife among his daughters. Some commentaries say that he also tells him he's running away from Esav. And look at Lavan's response in verse 14. And Lavan says to him, "But you are my essence, you are my flesh." And he settles down with him for a month. What's the but? Ach, atzmi v'sariyata. But you are my essence, you are my flesh. And commentaries note that Lavan was a bit disappointed. And Rashi, already in verse 13, quotes a midrash which says, why is Lavan hugging him? Why is he kissing him? Not because he really loves Yaakov. Lavan is doing it because Yaakov does not come with anything, with any wealth. Eliezer, the servant, came with 10 camels that were laden with tokens of his master's wealth. Yaakov comes empty-handed. When Lavan kisses him, when he hugs him, he's feeling him out to see maybe he has things in his pockets. Maybe he's hiding something in his mouth. And even if we don't buy the midrash and feel that this is very far-fetched, but perhaps when he says, ach, but, that may express his disappointment, his expectation that Yaakov would have come laden with silver and gold, but he comes empty-handed. But he nevertheless is his flesh and blood. And one could say, to Lavan's credit, that he invites Yaakov into his house for a month. Although the way the verse formulates it is that Yaakov settled down with him for a month. And then in verse 15, Lavan says to Yaakov, are you in fact my brother, and you will work for me for free? Tell me, what are your wages? And the rabbis infer from this verse that in fact, there's no such thing as a free lunch. That even during those 30 days that Yaakov spent with Lavan, Lavan charged him room and board by having him work for him to cover his expenses. In verse 15, it is clear that Yaakov is not leaving so fast, and hence Lavan wants to enter into a business arrangement with him. And once again, I raise the question, but was it not clear to Lavan that Yaakov is interested in marrying one of his daughters? And why wasn't that something which was raised at the very beginning and agreed upon at the very beginning? And somehow it seems that that's lost in the shuffle. Perhaps Yaakov is not pushing things so hard because Yaakov is not so ready to go back and have to encounter Esav. But nevertheless, it would seem that this should have been on the table from the very beginning. And it's only now that it's going to be articulated. And we're told in the following verses, Lavan has two daughters, Leah and Rachel. Leah's eyes are beautiful, but Rachel was beautiful of form, beautiful in appearance. Yaakov loves Rachel. And then we get to verse 18, in the middle, where it says, and Yaakov says, I will work 7 years for Rachel, your daughter, your youngest. Once again, the pshat would seem to be that Yaakov does not have the courage to ask Lavan for Rachel in marriage, gratis. Yaakov offers an unbelievable proposition. He will work for 7 years for Lavan. And note Lavan's response in verse 19. Better that I should give her to you than give her to someone else. Stay here. On the one hand, he agrees. On the other hand, let us go back to what he said at the time to Eliezer, the servant. Here it is. This is from God. Take her. Go. You don't get the sense of enthusiasm. It's more of a kind of resignation. Well, I have to give her to somebody, so I may as well give her to you than to give her to someone else. Here, sit here. And then we're told how Yaakov works and how the time passes so quickly because of his love. And then in verse 21, Yaakov comes and says, give me my wife. My days have been filled. Meaning, I have fulfilled my side of the bargain. I have worked 7 years. Give her to me that I might come upon her. Note the fact that Yaakov says, give me my wife. Not Rachel. From his perspective, she's already his. Technically, she's his wife. She's his wife, but she's not his wife because he's not living with her. He has not consummated the marriage. And Yaakov expresses that dichotomy when he says, and let me come upon her. Let me go back for 1 second. When Yaakov initially negotiated it, he said, I'll work 7 years for Rachel, your daughter, your youngest. And this is something which bothers the rabbis. Why the details? And the explanation which is given is that, at the very least, Yaakov feels that he's dealing with someone who is deceptive, and he therefore needs to make it perfectly clear what the agreement is, so that there will not be any misunderstanding or any room for deception. So that it's clear, this is the person that I am working for. And now let us get to the continuation. Lavan gathers the men of the place in verse 22. He makes a party. At night he takes Leah, brings her to Yaakov, and Yaakov comes upon her. He gives her Zilpah, his servant, to be Leah's servant. And in verse 25, in the morning, Yaakov wakes up and behold, this is Leah. And I'm not going to go into how is it that Yaakov didn't know who she was when he got married. But he comes to Lavan and says to him, what did you do? Didn't I work for you to get Rachel? And he says, Lama rimitani, why did you deceive me? And Lavan's response is, this type of thing is not done in our place. To give the youngest before the eldest. And I would like to focus on that comment. Let us assume that it's true. That in fact, Leah's the oldest daughter. And the custom is that you in fact marry off the oldest before the youngest. But why wasn't that made clear at the very beginning? At least giving Yaakov the chance to refuse. Why wasn't it made clear when Yaakov said, give me my wife, that Lavan would make it clear, you're getting Le'ah. At this point, it's very hard to explain Lavan as being somebody who is righteous, innocent, well-meaning. It is clear that there has been an act of deception, manipulation, exploitation with this righteous facade which is being presented. And after Lavan says, we don't do things like this, immediately he says, complete this week, and I'll give you that one also for the work that you will do another 7 years. Once again, even if I assume that there's a legitimate point in saying, I'd like to see my oldest daughter married first, but there's a feeling of deception, so then let Lavan give him Rachel without having to work another 7 years. And I just want to look at one thing in this verse, which maybe says it all. When he says, complete this week, and we will give you also this one, Rachel is no longer a person. She's no longer someone with a name. She's an it. She's an object. And perhaps that's exactly the image of Lavan. Lavan treats people as objects, as means, rather than an end. His relationship is an I-it relationship rather than an I-thou relationship. People are there to be used in order to be able to build him up. And in fact, this is articulated later in the parsha when Yaakov calls his wives at the very end and says, God appeared to me and I'd like to go back. I'd like to go back to the land of Israel. Will you come with me? And if we look at chapter 31, verse 14, and Rachel and Leah respond to him and say, do we have any portion, any inheritance in the house of our father? Are we not considered by him to be strangers, foreigners? He sold us. He has eaten up all of our money. Everything which we have has been saved by God to give to us and to our children. So whatever God says, do. Those words show how even after 20 years, Rachel and Leah are very bitter about having been treated as objects by their father. I would like to end by saying, at the Seder, when we tell the story of the Exodus, there is a passage which is expounded upon, taken from Deuteronomy chapter 26. And the story of the Exodus begins with Arami Oved Avi, which is understood by some commentary to mean my father was a wandering Aramean, a reference being made to Jacob. Jacob, who spent his time in Aram, in Haran, and who wandered, eventually coming down to Egypt. But there is another interpretation, which is actually expounded upon in the Haggadah. The Arami is Lavan, the Aramean, as he is described in our Parsha, Lavan ha-Arami. Oved means he wanted or tried to cause to perish my father. And in the Haggadah it says, go and see, go and learn, go out and learn, that in fact Lavan was worse than Pharaoh. Pharaoh only wanted decreed upon the males, but Lavan wanted to uproot everything. A very astounding rabbinic comment. And perhaps this rabbinic comment is related to what appears at the very end of the parsha. When Jacob runs away, Lavan chases after him. And God appears to Lavan in a dream and says, leave Jacob alone. And it is unclear from the text, what does Lavan want to do? Were he to catch up to Jacob? And if we just look at one statement which he makes, chapter 31, verse 43. After Jacob gives a whole accounting to Lavan and basically says to him, why are you chasing after me? What do you want from me? Ultimately, God is the one who has protected me all this time. Lavan responds and says to Jacob, the daughters The women are my daughters. The children are my children. The sheep are my sheep. Everything that you see is mine. And to my daughters, what would I do today, or to their children that they have given birth to? Lavan is basically expressing to Jacob what he really believes. Everything that you have is mine, and should remain mine. When the rabbis say Lavan wanted to uproot everything, it could be understood that Lavan wanted to destroy Jacob and is chasing after him, to kill him. But it could be that Lavan wants to do something which was equally bad. Not to kill Jacob and his family, but to retrieve them, to bring them back, to keep them as his possession forever, to assimilate them into his household, to destroy them spiritually, to destroy their identity, to make them into non-entities who are there to serve him. The danger of a person like Lavan is that Lavan is able to project an image, which is very positive. He's able to be very articulate, to be very convincing, to be able to make it seem that he's the victim, when in fact he is the oppressor. He's very cunning, very shrewd. He knows how to capitalize on a situation, to manipulate things, to achieve his goal, his agenda, which is ultimately his self-aggrandizement. As Yaakov says, had God not intervened, he would have succeeded. But perhaps something else which is also important to note is that Yaakov, Rachel, Leah see through the charade. They are able to call a spade for a spade, even though it's not going to change Lavan's behavior. He will continue to be a manipulator, but it will enable them to no longer be victimized, because they have pulled the mask off. In the Haggadah and Pesach, we say, in every generation, they stand up to destroy us, but God saves us from their hands. And perhaps the Haggadah also wants to make it clear. There are some times when people try to destroy us by the sword, and there are some times when people try to destroy us with sweet words. Which is worse? Something to consider. Shabbat Shalom.
Thank you, Rabbi Schweiger. Your comments on the podcast are always appreciated. Please send your emails to podcasts@pardesusa.org. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you on the next episode of Pardes from Jerusalem.